House Committee on Judiciary Policy and Finance will come to order. Legislative Assistant, would you call the roll, please?
Chairman Smith?
Here.
Vice Chair Szymanski?
Present.
Representative Johnson?
Here.
Representative Anderson?
Here.
Representative Champion?
Here.
Representative Cornish?
Here.
Representative Grunhagen?
Here.
Representative Hillstrom?
Here.
Representative Creasel?
Here.
Representative Lane is excused. Representative Lesh?
Here.
Representative Liebling?
Here.
Representative Mazerol?
Here.
Representative Maleen?
Here.
Representative Schumacher?
Here.
Representative Vogel?
Present.
Representative Wardlow?
Present.
Chair notes that we do have a quorum, so we'll get right on with business. First of all, we've got minutes from the April 12 meeting. Representative Johnson, have you read the minutes?
They look very good, Mr. Chair.
Can I have a motion from you?
I move to approve.
Representative Johnson moves approval of the minutes for April 12, 2011. Any discussion? Hearing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. Motion prevails. The minutes from April 12 this year are approved. Members, we've got a number of bills today, a full agenda, and this is our last hearing before the break next week. So if it's necessary to conclude this agenda, and by the way, a number of these bills will be laid over, I'll announce that when we get to them, but if we don't finish our business, we simply will have to resume this hearing, recess and resume the hearing after our business is finished on the floor. So just want to give everyone a heads up, see if we can't get through this morning. If not, we'll recess. First bill on the agenda would be House File 506, Representative Szymanski, fourth degree assault crime, etc. We're bringing this bill back before the committee. Representative Szymanski, 506 as amended. Motion.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I do have an amendment to the delete all amendment.
Representative, move the bill first, then move the amendment, and then let's discuss.
Chairman, I move House File 506 as amended to be considered and passed to the General Register.
Okay. Before us, let's do the amendment.
Mr. Chairman?
The A1 amendment?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, the A1 amendment simply fixes up the language, gets it in the proper format so that the bill would be in proper order passing through this committee.
Let's get your bill amended. Members, the Representative Szymanski moves the A1 amendment. All those in favor of the motion say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. Motion prevails. A1 amendment is adopted. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This bill has been presented, House File 506, previously in this committee. When we first presented House File 506 in the Public Safety Committee, there was some concern about the terms of the policy, the provisions of the bill, especially the term posse. So we redrafted the bill through the delete all amendment to change it to a law enforcement assistant in defining reserve officers and so forth. Other than that, nothing new in the testimony on this bill.
Very good, Representative Szymanski. Is there anyone in the audience wishing to be heard in testimony on this bill? Raise your hand. I see nobody, so the public testimony is now closed. Is there any discussion on the committee on House File 506 as amended? If there is none, then Representative Szymanski renews his motion 506 as amended be recommended to pass and place on the General Register. Those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, now we'll bring forward House File 1124, Representative Anderson. I was prepared to suggest you weren't here and try to take care of this business quickly, but since you are, let's still try to move it along. Representative Anderson, this bill, House File 1124, as amended, is back before the committee. The chair moves House File 1124 as amended be recommended to pass and be placed on the general register. You care to address the committee?
The motion and look forward to your action.
This bill has been heard before. Committee, any questions on the bill? Any discussion? Hearing none. Chair renews his motion that House File 1124, as amended, be recommended to pass and be placed on the general register. Those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. Motion prevails.
Thank you,
Representative.
Chair,
Chair now brings forward House File 32, Representative Dill. Representative Dill, it'll be the intention of the chair to grant you a full hearing, but then lay the bill over, and we'll get to it later. So the chair is going to move House File 32 that it be recommended to pass, be placed on the general register, and when we're through with testimony, I'll lay it over. Representative Dill, go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Smith, members. The bill is about tort liability for outdoor recreation activities. As this tort liability was raised over the course of the years, this particular thing has caused great difficulty for outdoor recreational activities. In getting the requirement is $1.5 million, and it's difficult to for the particularly snowmobile clubs, which I'm involved in, to be able to get the extra $500,000. So in practicality, what they end up doing is getting $2 million, and that is a problem in cost and expense, and isn't necessary, because there is all of the years that I have been involved, I do not believe, and that's over two decades, there has never been a claim substantiated in a court of law against any landowner or any snowmobile club. So we believe that the amount is correct. The original amount of $1 million is quite easy to get then. We worked through two different committees, twice through the Representative Westrom's committee, to get the language correct and to get the folks on board, the insurance companies, and the outdoor recreational groups have all come together and worked on this language. And I think there's one organization that is opposing that. With me is Mr. Franzen. He was involved with writing some legislation with another legislator that gave exclusion of liability for landowners, but not for snowmobile clubs or not for other outdoor people who are engaged in outdoor recreational activities under a permit. And I am not an attorney, as most of you are, and so I would defer any questions to him.
You have your witness at the table. Is there anyone in the audience wishing to be heard in favor of this bill? Raise your hand. Okay, I see one. I see two. Anyone wishing to be heard in opposition to the bill? I see another one. We're going to try to limit any testimony to roughly 10 minutes so we can proceed. Do you have any testimony, or are you here for questions?
Mr. Chairman, members, I'd like to say a few preliminary words explaining the bill and the public policy behind it, why it's good public policy. Mr. Chairman, members, my name is Doug Franzen. I'm an attorney representing the Minnesota United Snowmobilers Association. And Mr. Chairman, over the years, Democrats have done something really smart, and Republicans have done something very smart. What you both have done is found people, Minnesota citizens, who love Minnesota and love getting out doing it, and leverage their passion into volunteer work to perform public good services, trails, recreational opportunities for all Minnesotans that otherwise would be very expensive. And it's probably the most cost-efficient thing the state of Minnesota does. And we thank you for that over the years. That's a short introduction to saying that much of our snowmobile trail system, which is extensive, approximately 25,000 miles of snowmobile trails run through Minnesota, phenomenal tourism dollars, we're talking hundreds of millions of dollars annually in economic impact, and a phenomenal thing is the backbone is volunteer clubs. that, and these are not great people of means. These are not lawyers and entrepreneurs. These are ordinary folks from your district, your constituents. They band together, and frankly, they don't have a lot of money. They struggle. They work through the grant and aid program to develop and maintain this 25,000 miles. Oh, of this 25,000 miles, by the way, approximately 800 to 1,000 are state trails. The rest are grant and aid trails developed and maintained by local clubs, your constituents, in agreement with local units of government, counties, townships, cities, and landowners who volunteer their land for free recreational opportunities for all Minnesotans. The point is there's not a ton of money. We have bake sales, we sell hot dogs, we make this work. Our experience as snowmobilers is not unlike that of other recreational groups, ATVers, etc. Several years ago, the state increased the municipal tort liability limit. And along with that, because we actually perform these services to the state under an agreement with either the state or the local unit of government, are the unit of government or the state rightly wants the club to cover its exposure. So our insurance costs went up as well, from roughly $1 million to the $1.5 million. Many, many clubs found it difficult, if not cost prohibitive, to go to the market. It was, by and large, the majority of policies were a $2 million minimum. A few $1.5 million policies have evolved. However, they are not cost effective. These little clubs are spending hundreds of thousands of dollars, and our position and the fundamental position behind this bill is it is unnecessary. What this bill does is for recreational opportunities involving a unit of government through a outdoor recreational for a unit of government, state, local, where a permit or a contract is required, the municipal or state liability limit would be $1 million. This would reduce our costs back to a manageable level. We have no problem doing that. It more than covers the exposure. As Representative Dill said, I've been at this as well for about 25 years. I've never seen a jury verdict holding a snowmobile club liable. Simply, there is no evidence that there is that exposure to justify a higher limit. Having said that, I want to separate the issues very quickly. One is what we are charged, or any user is charged, by the unit of government. The exposure, theoretically at least, there may be a large walk for breast cancer opportunity that may have higher exposure. The government can, and this bill does nothing about its ability, restricting or otherwise modifying its ability to say, no, for this scope of an activity, we need $2 million or $5 million insurance. That's appropriate. All we are saying that the threshold, the stop, the tort liability for government should go to $1 million. Now, and our reason is generally we have to buy the insurance to cover government's exposure. Now, if the government wants more, fine. There is nothing in that relieves our liability for a $10 million judgment, other groups' liabilities. What we are betting on is that the experience of at least the last quarter century, if not longer, will bear out that we're not going to see that exposure. There have been, I think, three arguments made against this bill. Number one, it's well and good for the little snowmobile clubs and little ATV clubs, the folks back home, but large nonprofits, I think Blue Cross was mentioned, fine company, by the way, having one of their big fitness events, taking advantage of this, and that might be a problem. I thought about that, Mr. Chairman. It's not a problem. It's good. First of all, if more money can go to breast cancer or something as opposed to the insurance company, that's a good thing. Secondly, as I said before, the sponsoring unit of government can charge whatever level of insurance require whatever level of insurance is appropriate. The second question I've heard is that why do you need this at all? Snowmobile clubs are immune from liability. Unfortunately, that's an incorrect reading of the law, Mr. Chairman. It's not true. We wish it was. I think the reference is to the landowner liability law. It's been on the books for a number of years. There is nothing in that immunizes snowmobile clubs. And to take that argument, if I was wrong and the trial bar was right on that, there'd be absolutely no need for insurance because there's no exposure. And, Mr. Chairman, I forgot the third argument against this. So it must not have been very persuasive.
Mr. Branson, that's okay because it's refreshing to have someone give dual testimony both for and against the bill all in the same spot. But if you've forgotten your third point, so be it.
That's right. Mr. Chairman, in deference to the committee, I was just trying to save time for the hearing.
We have other testifiers in favor of the bill. Step forward. I'm going to ask you to limit yourself to 2 minutes. Tell us two things, what the bill does and why you support it.
My name is Karen Umfress. I'm a government relations officer for ARMCA. It's the Dirt Bike Riders. I got so flustered about my 2 minutes. I'm also representing a coalition, and the coalition is dirt bike riders, is ATVers, but it's also rollerbladers, bicyclists, and fishermen. And we've gotten together and tried to work on language in this bill, basically. It's good for all of our recreationists. My local dirt bike club does a trail ride. The trail ride has about 100 people. Of those people, 25% of them are kids under 16. It's a very family-oriented recreation. The first million of insurance I can get is part of the American Motorcyclist Association for about $275. The second million is about 200% over that. The first year that this bill went into place, my club lost $500 on this trail ride. And we actually ended up having to not pay reimburse expenses for our club members because we didn't have the funds to do that. The Norsemen is another dirt bike club. They've been putting on consecutive events for many, many years. This year will be the 53rd consecutive event for motorcyclists in the Snake Creek Forest. They have never had a liability claim against them, much less a settlement. So we are very much in favor of this bill. It's going to help all of our local dirt bike clubs. It's going to help rollerbladers. It's going to help bicyclists. It's going to help fishing competitions come into the state. And we really need its passed. And we're available for questions. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Additional testimony in favor of the bill? Step forward. No. Testimony against? Morning. State your name and proceed, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Joel Carlson. I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Association for Justice, and we do have some concerns with the bill, not its intent, but we believe that the limits in the bill, the way it's drafted, and how it would be utilized has substantial unintended consequences. And as Mr. Franson testified for me, you need to know that the language of the bill for a nonprofit organization does not simply involve a small trail club or an event that they may be organized. According to the National Run, Walk, and Ride Fundraising Council, events covered by this bill generate nationally over $1.76 billion of revenue. The Relay for Life generates $430 million. The Leukemia Walk is $125 million. The Komen Run for the Cure, which I've participated in many times, generated $113 million, all of which are done under the confines of this bill. And I respectfully disagree with Mr. Franson. This bill does not allow, this is a hard cap on claims. This bill does not allow It maybe allows a government to require more insurance. That doesn't matter. This limits all claims to this level. And you need to know that Chapter 466, relating to local units of government, on page 2 of the bill, has a specific provision that says if you purchase insurance above the cap, above the liability cap, that you waive that up to the level of your insurance. This bill has no similar protection, and we've testified to that before. And Mr. Chairman and members, we are trying to address an insurance problem with a liability cap. And the reason I think that has unintended consequences are situations like the Holidazzle Parade, an outdoor activity in downtown Minneapolis organized by a nonprofit. That parade had a substantial accident, millions of dollars of damage, death, over 13 people injured, and this bill places a hard cap on any nonprofit organizing an event like that where there is a substantial risk of harm and has been, and this bill places a hard cap on those damages, and we think that it is unfair to solve an insurance problem with a cap on damages, which is a hard cap. I gave some information to the Civil Law Committee from the ATV Association, and they talk about their insurance premiums for their trail rides, which can be obtained for as low as $161. When you look at the top nonprofits in Minnesota and their substantial revenues, all of whom would be covered by this bill, many of them are institutions of higher learning. Bethel, Carleton, McAllister, Concordia, Hamline, all substantial nonprofit companies that would be protected by this bill for all of the activities that they organize that are outdoor recreational activities. We think the bill, as it relates to the trail clubs, there's never been a claim. Never. That's not our problem. The problem is that this bill is overly broad, has unintended consequences, and is, I think, likely constitutionally infirm because you're setting up two different sets of defendants with different liability caps. And so we have serious concerns about the bill, not as it relates to the trail club. That is not our heart. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Happy to answer questions.
Thank you, sir. Anyone else wishing to testify? If not, the public testimony is closed. We'll return it to discussion to the committee. Any questions at this time, Representative Johnson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Dill, could you give me some context about what the difference in cost is? I'm trying to, since that seems to be the issue on the amount of money for purchasing this tort liability. What is the difference between $1 million and $2 million? Are we talking a lot of money?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First off, the $1.5 million is very difficult to get. That's what the amount of the tort liability requirement is. The $2 million is quite easy to get, and it's usually about double. And so you have a snowmobile club or an ATV club that already is doing, I mean, we're not, Mr. Carlson's right, we're not the Walk for Life and Breast Cancer Relay, and thank you for all of that, because that's all important, and it raises an incredible amount of money towards people's a lot of grief that is had by those folks that experience those kinds of diseases and things that those benefit. And I'm very thankful we have them. Very thankful people are generous. But it gets down to the fact that when you have a local organization, let's say in your community, when your local Legion Hall decides to raise a few money, some money to pay for their property taxes for their Legion Hall, which in your local community is used as for weddings and every other imaginable community event. And just, I mean, it's endless what these facilities, these small groups, use these buildings for. Our snowmobile club has a building in the middle out of Crane Lake. We use it for weddings and for funerals and everything that's necessary in our small community, because we don't have a community center, but we've got this beautiful garage which we keep our equipment in, and we move all the equipment out and they use the building. Well, it doubles the cost. And I mean, it doubles the cost when there's finite resources, no different than the state, but on a much larger magnitude, no different than we're dealing with every single day on the House floor in this legislature. And it's just, it gets to be where that you burn out the volunteers for absolutely no reason. the volunteers say enough is enough. We can't sell any more hot dogs. We can't have any more bake sales. We're not doing it. We've got families to raise. This is too expensive. So then our resorts suffer. The gas stations suffer. Everybody starts to go down. I've had more calls. I've been an administrator of a trail system for over 25 years. And when this went to $1.5 million, I got more calls on that one thing in 1 year than I got on any other subject in that I deal with as a legislator, from chambers who put on fishing derbies, legions, Eagles clubs, snowmobile clubs, ATV clubs, ski trail associations. All of those kinds of organizations all have this problem. And the insurance company has to go out to get reinsurance for that $500,000, but they'll easily write internally the $2 million. They're not geared to set that. And frankly, a community like my own sponsoring community of my trail system says, well, it's $1.5 million in the law. You got to have $1.5 million in insurance. They don't even know what this is about in the local community. The local town, 200-person town administrator, I don't know, just $1.5 million is the number. That's what you got to have. So that's the reason we're here, and it's a problem.
Representative Johnson. Any other questions? Any discussion? Representative Dill, thank you. Chair will lay the bill over under its motion. All right, we're going to move down to House File 708, Representative Champion. Representative Champion, as you're going to the table, I'd like you to move the bill, and then it would be my intent to lay it over. Move the bill, be recommended to pass to the General Register, and then I'd like to lay it over after testimony and discussion. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, committee, thank you. I would like to move House File 708.
Thank you, Representative Champion. The bill is before the committee. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, House File 708 is really a simple bill. What it is that under Minnesota Statute 491A, if a matter comes before the conciliation court and there is a rendering or finding by the judge in conciliation court, a person who may have gotten a favorable judgment could still appeal to the district court. Or a person who may have not gotten a favorable judgment could still appeal to the district court, and it would be what we call a trial de novo, which means is as if the lower issue never happened. This particular bill before you seeks to make sure that there's some equity when we think in terms of the process. What is clear is that a moving party, so let's say for an example, a person goes to conciliation court and they lose and they appeal. They become a moving party, means the first party who serves or files a demand for removal. The remaining party seeks a reversal in whole or in part for a conciliation court decision and has appealed, as I stated. The rule provides that this person who loses or who wins, it doesn't matter, has a right to provide notice, and that notice will say if the moving party does not prevail in district court, the opposing party may be awarded an additional $50 or something for costs. An opposing party means any party as to whom the removing party seeks a reversal in whole or in part. So currently, as I mentioned earlier, if the removing party prevails in district court by getting a judgment or recovering at least $500 or 50% of the amount of the value of the property that the removing party requested on removal, if it is less, the opposing party gets their costs paid. So let me put it in layman's terms, because we keep hearing all the removing party and the opposing party. If I, Bobby Champion, goes to conciliation court, if I get a judgment against, let's say, Chair Smith, and let's say I win in conciliation court, Chair Smith,
I hope you have a good lawyer when you go into this.
Absolutely, Chair Smith. Chair Smith says, you know what, I don't like this judgment. But let's say, for an example, the judgment I get against Chair Smith is roughly $3,000 or $3,500. So Chair Smith appeals. We go to district court. District court still agrees with me, but instead of me receiving $3,500, the district court says, Mr. Champion, you're only going to get $3,000. Chair Smith, under that scenario, under the current law, can say, well, Your Honor, I move that Mr. Champion has to pay my cost because he received a judgment that was $500 less than what he received in conciliation court. And under the current statute, he would be right, even though I still prevail. I think that there's something inherently wrong with that scenario. Even though I have nothing against Chair Smith, it's just that even though it's a small amount of money, there is no equity in the scenario that I just articulated. And that's what this bill is about. So it simply strikes the language in the current statute that will provide for the outcome that I just articulated. But let's say, for an example, in our same scenario, I win in conciliation court, but I, being the victor, says, hey, $3,500 is not enough. I think Chair Smith should pay me $7,000. So I'm going to appeal the action of the conciliation court judge. So we go to the district court level. Instead of me getting a verdict now on the trial court level at least the $3,500 that I received on the conciliation court level, let's say the trial court judge says, you lose totally. You get zero. Under the law as it is right now, I still would have to pay Mr. Smith's or Chair Smith's cost. Why? Well, under that scenario, it makes sense because I appealed to the trial court. I lose. Therefore, I put Mr. Smith or Chair Smith through an added burden. And so I just believe that the law should and the statute should really conform to that form of thinking. Whoever is the victor is the one who should be able to ask for court costs, especially if they are the moving party or the opposing party. It just depends. Whoever wins.
Representative Champion, thank you for your presentation. Do you have any testifiers in favor of the bill?
I do. I have one. Mr. Dietrich Mays.
Come forward. Is there anyone present in the audience wishing to testify against this bill? Raise your hand. All right, let's go to your testifier. Tell us your name, sir, and go ahead.
My name is Dietrich Mays, and it's basically just what Mr. Champion was saying. I went to conciliation court on against a nightclub owner in downtown Minneapolis. I received a verdict, and they appealed, and we went to district court, and that verdict was basically cut in half. I still prevailed on both levels, but it was cut in half, and like Mr. Champion said, under that law, I had to pay their costs after the district court basically cut the amount in half.
Mr. Mays, thank you. Appreciate your time this morning. Any before you leave, any questions of the witness from the table? I see none. Thank you. No further testimony. Then the public testimony is closed. Any questions of the author of the bill? I don't see any. Thank you, Representative Champion. We'll lay the bill over, and after the break, we'll see if we can get back to it and get on with it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yes, sir. All right, we're going to move along to House File 211, Representative Wardlow, Unlawful or Deceptive Trade Practice, etc. Ready? Representative Wardlow, I'd like you to move your bill, and then we'll take testimony and questions, and it will be the chair's intent to lay this bill over as well. So go ahead with your motion, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move House File 211 with recommendation to pass and be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means.
All right, that's the motion on the table. Go ahead and present your bill. Do you have testifiers with you today? Or not?
One possible rebuttal testifier, if necessary.
Is there anyone in the audience wishing to be heard on this bill and testimony? Raise your hand now. I see one hand. Any other hands? I see two hands. Okay, we're going to try to limit presentation and testimony to 10 minutes. Go ahead, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 211 members is important as a job creation and business climate improvement measure to reduce the costs of unnecessary litigation, meritless litigation, frivolous litigation, in particular class action litigation in the state of Minnesota. By doing so, we'll make Minnesota a better place to do business and hopefully attract businesses to come to our state and encourage entrepreneurial activity here. The bill basically has two parts. The first part modifies the Private Attorney General Statute, Section 8.31, with regard to the Unlawful Trade Practices Act, the Consumer Fraud Act, and the False Statement and Advertising Act. It makes two basic changes. First, it implements a requirement that there be a showing of detrimental reliance on alleged deceptive acts or fraudulent acts alleged in either a class action or just a regular action. And secondly, it bars recovery of any damages except on showing of actual out-of-pocket loss. And out-of-pocket loss is defined as the difference between the actual fair market value of the goods or services received by the person claiming to have been damaged and what the plaintiff expected to receive based on the fraudulent or the allegedly deceptive or fraudulent statements. The second part modifies the process for class action certification appeals. So when the class action is going forward, members, one of the initial steps is the judge must certify the class based on various factors such as numerosity and making sure that the plaintiffs before the court are representative of the class. Once the court makes an order or enters an order certifying the class, saying, okay, this is a class that is proper and ready to go, oftentimes the case rises or falls on that decision. Oftentimes facing the prospect of a jury, and we all know that juries can do many different things and are very difficult to predict, and facing a potentially very large class, a business will just go ahead and settle once a class has been certified, unnecessarily settle, and pay perhaps unnecessary costs because, members, a class certification order can't be appealed until the end of the entire trial process, or in the case of be it a jury trial or a court trial. So this changes the way class certification orders are handled and allows for interlocutory appeal, or rather immediate appeal of the class certification order after it is issued as a matter of right to the Court of Appeals, so that defendants and plaintiffs can get an immediate answer as to whether the class certification order was properly made instead of waiting until the end. And then if the class certification order, if the Court of Appeals says no, this class was not properly certified, the matter is over. And the business doesn't have to pay unnecessary costs for a meritless, pay an unnecessary settlement for a meritless lawsuit. If the class certification order comes down from the Court of Appeals and it is affirmed, then everything goes forward and the plaintiffs have certainty that their class certification was indeed proper and they don't face the prospect of appeal after the jury trial process of the class certification order. So it improves the process in a number of ways in that regard and basically reduces the costs of settling meritless litigation, class action litigation for our job creators. The bill does have a fiscal note, $76,000. That's a small price to pay for improving Minnesota's business climate with regard to our increasingly litigious society and making sure that going forward, Minnesota is not a haven for these kinds of lawsuits. So I ask for your support.
Any additional testimony in favor of the bill? Testimony in opposition? Step forward. While you're coming up to the table, let's go to questions. I see Representative Hillstrom. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How do you pay for your bill? It has a cost. How do you pay for it?
Representative Wardlaw.
The $76,000 cost?
Yep.
Well, the bill will be moved to Ways and Means. Well, it will be laid over, but if it were to be sent to Ways and Means, then there, my understanding that there is money within the targets that would be available to pay for minor bills like these with small costs.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's my understanding that the governor's office and the department has said that the current budget that's passed is $1.9 billion short of meeting that target. So where is their money in the budget?
Representative Wardlaw.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Pilstrom. I don't know what basis the governor has for making that statement. I don't believe his statement is accurate as to whatever he said about the budget not being in balance, so I wouldn't know how to respond.
Right. Representative Pilstrom, anything else?
No, Mr. Chair.
Well, this bill will be laid over, so you'll have an opportunity to reload for a later date. Testimony.
Thank you, Chairman. My name is Sharon Van Dyke. I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Association for Justice. I'm a solo practitioner in St. Louis Park. I look at this bill as a cure in search of a problem. The stated purpose of the bill, I don't think anybody could disagree with, which is job creation and improving the economic climate in this state for jobs. That's a wonderful goal. My problem is I don't think this bill does anything to fix that. First and foremost, the Consumer Fraud Protection Act and the trade, the three bills that are ultimately affected by this, the three statutes, aren't applicable to an honest, upstanding Minnesota business. If you're honest, upstanding, and not involved in deceptive trade practices or consumer fraud, you're never going to have to deal with this bill. This is a bill, these statutes are intended to, you know, punish, frankly, make people pay businesses that are not above board. And I think that needs to be kept in mind. With respect to this particular bill, the purposes of these statutes was to help the Attorney General's office monitor fraud and deceptive trade practices. Private Attorney General Bill, which is 8.31, was an acknowledgement of the fact that the Attorney General lacks the resources to monitor when businesses are stepping astray. And the people in the best position to take care of that are ordinary people, ordinary some other small businesses that are getting ripped off or cheated by bigger businesses who are not playing by the rules. That's the purpose of the bill, to make it, to give the little guys incentive to do what they needed to do under this bill. They provided the Private Attorney General statute. Number one, this bill, there are several problems with this bill. The first is the requirement of that you plead and prove individual reliance, and the second is that you prove out-of-pocket loss. What that essentially does is eliminate the potential for a class action certification at all, because it defies numerosity, which is one of the primary things you have to have a class. How does that impact the actual running of a case like this? Florida is an outstanding example. Number one, it prevents small frauds. If you have a whole lot of small fraud and you have to have everybody prove that some specific thing allow, you know, caused them to rely on it and they lost, you know, $2.15, they're never going to bring a case they can't possibly afford to. The larger ones, but it doesn't just affect small ones. It affects large ones. There's a tobacco, light tobacco case in Florida based on a consumer protection statute that's exactly like ours as it currently stands. Class was decertified under rules similar to what's in this bill, and we ended up, and because the damages were large, the people went ahead and did it. The Florida courts are clogged. Instead of having one large class action dealing with all of the fraud issues, we now have 8,000 to 9,000 individual cases going through the Florida District Court system. If the purpose of this bill is to decrease litigation, I don't think having 8,000 cases instead of one case is a very good way to do it. The courts are underfunded as it is. With respect to the appeal process, Minnesota already has the ability in a meritorious case for an interlocutory appeal on class certification. That already exists under Minnesota law. It's discretionary with the trial court. Unless we want to assume that our district court judges are not doing their jobs, they're going to certify one if they believe that it's proper. For an automatic appeal like this, you end up with yo-yo effect. Class gets certified, it goes up to the Court of Appeals. The Court of Appeals, let's say they decertify it. You go back down. You take three more depositions. Oh, we've changed the problem with it, according to the Court of Appeals. You recertify it. You go back up. You go back down. That's an increase in cost. The discretion matters. Why don't we leave that to the trial judge? And in closing, I would like to simply say, there has not, if you examine the filings in Minnesota with respect to the number of cases brought under these statutes, there are very, very, very few. So I don't understand how a few cases brought under this statute is going to have the kind of fiscal effect on jobs and all of that kind of thing that is being proposed as the reason behind the bill.
Thank you. Representative Johnson, do you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the testifier, when I was driving in this morning to the Capitol, listening to the radio, I heard a story about a class action suit against Dannon Yogurt. And Dannon Yogurt was making claims, apparently, that were not entirely true. And Dannon lost the class action suit or whatever. Is it my understanding that each individual purchaser of the yogurt then, under individual reliance, would have to prove that somehow they were negatively affected by their purchase?
That's what this bill does. I'm one of the people that bought that. Yes.
Any question can be answered one of three ways. Yes, no, or I don't know.
So yes.
Start, okay, and then now fill it in.
Yes. That's exactly what this bill does. I, as a purchaser of blueberry Dannon yogurt, would have to prove that I bought this one and it did match, you know, have this misleading stuff on it, that I relied on whatever it is that Dannon did when I bought this, and I would have to prove a change in my out-of-pocket cost, which frankly doesn't always exist.
Thank you. Representative Johnson, anything?
I guess to the author, usually when I see bills come forward of this nature that entail pretty big changes, there's some reason for it. There's some evidence that suggests a change of this magnitude is necessary. Do you have some evidence that there's been fraudulent class action certification in Minnesota that warrants this sort of intervention?
Representative Wardlow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Johnson, yes. By way of evidence, we have very poor court holdings in Minnesota, in particular the group health plan holding, where the Supreme Court of Minnesota, on responding to two certified questions from the District Court of Minnesota, this is group health plan versus Philip Morris, stated, and the two questions were as follows. One, let's see here. First question is not really relevant. The second question was, is individual reliance a requirement under our consumer fraud, deceptive trade practices, and false advertising statutes? And the court said no. The court said no, and the reasoning of the court, Alan Page's reasoning, frankly makes no sense to me. The court simply said that the individual statutes, the Consumer Fraud Act, the False Advertising Act, and the Deceptive Trade Practices Act, describe the conduct that would constitute a violation, and then noted that the Private Attorney General's statute did not require individual reliance, and then said, because for that reason, individual reliance is not required. Well, in fact, the common law fraud requires individual reliance, and we know that when a statute abrogates the common law, it needs to do so specifically, and it didn't do so specifically here. So the court's holding, I think, is flawed, and this bill fixes that.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just not clear. It doesn't. Were there were fraudulent class action suits that were presented then? Is that what you said? I was unclear on your point.
Representative Wardlow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Johnson. Well, I was talking about flawed holding, I believe, flawed in Group Health Plan versus Philip Morris, where the court eviscerated some of the limitations on our Private Attorney General statute. That's what this seeks to fix. We're looking forward. I think there are cases in which meritless litigation is brought all the time. just because you have a good faith basis as an attorney, and being a trial lawyer, I know this, and a lot of lawyers here, we all know this, you have a good faith basis to bring a case forward because you have a good faith basis that the elements of whatever causes of actions you're asserting exist, but you don't know for sure whether there is evidence of the actual allegations you're making because you haven't gotten to discovery yet. So yes, it is quite common that once you get through discovery, that there's a motion for summary judgment, the case goes away. So to say that cases are, I'm sorry,
Sharon Van Dyke.
Ms. Van Dyke. Ms. Van Dyke's comments to the effect that these different statutes, consumer protection statutes, are only applied to the bad actors is simply not true. Oftentimes, based on innuendo and entrepreneurial lawyering, perfectly good companies that have nothing wrong are roped into these statutes, and under the group health holding, it's much easier to do that in Minnesota than it was before the group health holding.
I guess no further questions. I mean, it doesn't sound like there's an epidemic of businesses being unfairly brought into court under this. I haven't just listening to your comments, but I'll pass at this point.
Very good. Thank you, Representative Wardlow. Comment, and then we'll move on to further testimony.
I would just say that we would not want an epidemic to happen, so we're trying to prevent that.
Further testifiers, come forward. Thank you, Ms. Van Dyke. See what you can do with 2 minutes, sir.
Mr. Chair, members, Ron Elwood, Legal Aid. First of all, I want to thank Representative Wardlow. He spent a lot of time with me discussing my concerns, and he was very receptive, and I really appreciate it. And in fact, the bill that's before you, I believe, does reflect some of the changes he made as a result of our conversation. So I really want to thank you. Despite the changes, however, unfortunately, we still have some concerns about the bill. First of all, I want to say that there is a high bar to certify a class, so it's not the easiest thing in the world to do. That's number one. Number two, on the group health case, the court did require there be a nexus and a causation factor in that case. So, I think that gets at some of the concerns I think that this bill is attempting to correct. The two other things I just mentioned would be that we would suggest that while I think the articulated purpose is certainly laudable, the consequence could potentially be something that we really don't want, which is to make Minnesota a haven for unscrupulous operators perpetrating fraud to come here if the bar is so high that it's impossible to take a class action. And the other point I'd make is that in a time when we're diminishing enforcement resources, I think the last thing we want to do is reduce the opportunity for private actions. Thank you, Mr.
Elwood, thank you. It's always good to have you here.
Thank you.
I think there was one other testifier in opposition. I see no further hands. Public testimony is closed. Questions? Discussion at this time? Any questions? Chair lays the bill over. Representative, thank you.
Thank you.
At this time, we're going to move back up the agenda to House File 199. Members, that will be the bill before us. And I just want to make a comment from the chair at this time. This bill is similar to a provision that was amended onto the Health and Human Services Omnibus Finance Bill. So many of the issues pertaining to this bill, House File 199, have already been discussed and debated by the body of the whole, and will be debated again if this bill should reach the floor. For purposes of today's hearing, this committee, and looking at the clock a little bit, I would ask that we do not reopen the debate on the federal health care law and try to remain confined to the bill before us and the sections that are before the purview of this committee. Additionally, I want to tell you that I frankly, personally, am sensitive to the fact that while the term Obamacare is a commonly used term outside this committee room, it's not going to be acceptable inside this committee room. We'll refer to it as the Affordable Care and Patient Protection Act. And anyone that chooses to not listen to what I'm asking for, you'll hear my gavel. So let's try to avoid bringing any personalities into this discussion, whether intentional or incidental. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for that information. And what would you say we're looking at with respect to this bill from this committee's perspective?
Those items that come before the purview of this committee, and we'll make it up as we go along. I just want to keep away from the issues of health and human services, the issue of personalities. I don't want to restrict this committee into looking, any member of this committee, to look at those areas of the bill that he or she thinks we need to be concerned with. Just stay away from health and human services and Obamacare, and you'll make us all happy. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I agree with that, but I was wondering, as a non-attorney, is there something in particular you think that we should be being aware of on this particular bill?
Representative Johnson, and
I'm just looking for more for guidance than try to be a wise guy or anything.
Representative Johnson, thank you. The reason I asked this bill to come to this committee, and the author of the bill should also listen, the bill, I think, addresses placing limitations on our court system, and that's the area I want to explore. Representative Gottwald, how many testifiers do you have with you?
Mr. Chair, I have two.
Okay, is there anyone besides the two that are with Representative Gottwald who want to testify in favor of this bill? Raise your hand. Anyone here wishing to testify in opposition to this bill? Raise your hand now. I don't see any hands, so we've got two testifiers. Let's try to keep your presentation and the testifiers to, say, 10 minutes, 15 tops. Go ahead. Representative Hillstrom.
This is an additional procedural question, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
So is it your intention to vote on this at the end? Are you laying this over? I mean, it's already part of a bill, so what is your intention to do with this piece?
I believe the motion that I'm going to make is that it be recommended to pass and be sent to the General Register.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Doesn't this have a fiscal note and a fiscal cost?
Not to my knowledge, no.
So no fiscal note has been requested, or the cost is zero?
Mr. Chair, there's
check
actually
your folder. I think we have the fiscal note inside.
It is.
I'm going to proceed with the testimony. If you do have questions, please interrupt, and I'll be happy to break away. Representative Gottwald, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I will try to focus my comments as you've directed. We'll refer to it as the ACA, which it is commonly referred to, but we will not refer to it by the term you mentioned earlier. I'll also try to focus comments on the bill today for the purposes of this committee on those that pertain to this committee and not on the other pieces, as you've also directed. This bill specifies that it is the public policy of Minnesota that every person in the state would be free to choose or decline any mode of securing health services without penalty, and it prohibits any public official from enforcing such a penalty. The bill requires the Attorney General to defend this policy and take action against violations of the policy and against laws or regulations violating this policy that are enacted without adequate federal funding. Mr. Chair, for the members' benefit, I think the main section we'd be looking at that falls under this committee's purview would be lines 3.4 through 3.8. And again, the bill itself states kind of at its core that every person within the state is and shall be free to choose or decline any mode of securing health care services without penalty or threat of penalty. And Mr. Chair, I'll wrap up my presentation of the bill with that and open it up for questions, unless you'd rather take our testimony first.
Let's go with the testimony. If we do have questions, I'm going to break in. Have your testifier come forward, give us their name, and then proceed.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Peter Nelson, and I'm an attorney and policy fellow with Center of the American Experiment. And I'd just like to begin by saying, you know, there's no doubt that the ACA causes a number of constitutional questions in regards to the role of the federal government. And if passed, HF 199 simply expresses the state's policy position on the proper bounds of the role of the federal government. And I understand that reasonable people can disagree on this issue, but you know, I hope that we can all agree that state officials, when they see something like the ACA and they believe something like the ACA is unconstitutional, it's very appropriate for state officials to stand up and take action to defend what they believe is an improper encroachment of federal power. And that is what I believe that this statute does. And I think, you know, we can look back to just not too long ago when this state legislature saw our governor, Governor Plenty, take action that they thought was inappropriate through the unallotment process. And they very appropriately took action to defend what they believed was the state's legislature's role in setting the budget and doing those sorts of things. Now, I happen to disagree with the state legislature at that time, but I certainly very much supported the state legislature's duty to actually take that sort of action to defend what they believed in that regard. And turning it now to the federal power issues, I do believe that's what this state statute actually does. And I think that's it's very appropriate in that regard. And to conclude, I want to address some of the Attorney General issues, because I think that the fact this statute brings up the Attorney General and directs the Attorney General to do certain things is very appropriate, because a lot of the people that are going to be affected by this statute are going to be those that are uninsured, who happen to be lower income people, and those people are not going to have the means to file lawsuits. And it's really important to actually have to get this lawsuit addressed in an expeditious manner. And the Attorney General, I believe, is the most appropriate place to actually get a timely resolution to any of these issues that come up. And I guess I'll end with one point, that this really just addresses the constitutional issues. I actually hope that this statute and moving forward that the state legislature would look at other issues as well, because I think when we look at how the statute is implemented over the next few years, that the statute is going to actually probably move beyond constitutional issues and move into statutory issues, and whether the federal government is moving beyond what the statute says is allowable. And this legislation doesn't allow for that.
We'll break into some questions at this point. Representative Johnson, then Maylene. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess to the testifiers, to bring up the Attorney General. Has the Attorney General taken a position on the Affordable Care Act, and if so, what is it?
It is my understanding that the Attorney General has taken a position that the ACA is constitutional. That's my understanding.
Representative Maylene.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the author. I was just looking at lines 2.1 through 2.5 that say the power to acquire, regulate a person's choice in the mode of securing health care services or to impose a penalty related to that choice is not found in the Constitution of the United States of America and is therefore a power reserved to the people pursuant to the Ninth Amendment and to the several states pursuant to the Tenth Amendment. And Representative Gottwalt, I was just wondering, because in our Constitution we also find three separate and distinct branches of government, and it's, you know, traditionally the judiciary and the court system that determines the constitutionality of law, whether that be federal or state law. So I was wondering if you could explain, you know, sort of how your bill respects an independent judiciary and their role in interpreting the constitutionality of our laws.
Representative Gottwalt. Try to limit your answer to a couple of hours.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll keep it much briefer than a couple of hours. Thank you for the question, Representative. You know, this does not speak to the three branches of the government specifically. This talks about the state's rights under the Ninth and Tenth Amendments of the U.S. Constitution. And specifically, that the U.S. Constitution, you know, where it does not specifically give the power to the federal government, not talking about the three branches, but the federal government versus states governments, those rights are reserved to the states. And so under the existing Ninth and Tenth Amendments in the U.S. Constitution, which give rights to the states, that actually protect rights of the states, we are simply making that statement that, you know, in a sense reminding people in Minnesota, pursuant to this entire statute, that Minnesota has rights under the U.S. Constitution, under the Ninth and Tenth Amendments, and that that is what we are invoking when we say we want to protect individuals' rights to choose their form of health care coverage or choose not to.
Representative Mehling, first of all, I apologize. I was not trying to belittle your question. It was and is a very serious question, but I know my Republican colleague, and I know he likes to talk, and I was aiming my barb at him, not you. Representative Mehling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Gottwald, I guess, you know, my only comment to that would be that we also have the Supremacy Clause in the Constitution, and I believe the testifier just stated that the Attorney General's position has been that this is a constitutional act, and, in fact, several federal judges around the nation have found it to be constitutional. So I'm not sure how we can try to trump federal law through your bill. And you know, there was a bill that passed through committee yesterday on party lines that I think would ultimately be found to be unconstitutional in a court of law, but I guess I wouldn't introduce a bill declaring it unconstitutional, because I believe that that's the court's job. So thank you.
Representative Gottwald, brief response.
I would just point out again, Mr. Chair, and Representative Mehling, that again, Minnesota has certain rights under the U.S. Constitution. We're not committing an unconstitutional act by protecting people's individual rights and states' rights under the existing U.S. Constitution.
We've got some other questioners here, Representative Liebling, Hillstrom, and Wardlaw. I would prefer to moderate this discussion, but I hope someone might discuss the issue of checks and balances as well. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, there is a lot to talk about here, and it really doesn't have a lot that doesn't have to do with health care. So actually, I'm glad for the opportunity to discuss this in this setting rather than on the floor. But a couple of things that Mr. Nelson said that I want to respond to. First of all, Mr. Nelson, you talked about, oh, this is just expressing the policy of the state. Well, if it only were expressing the policy, I don't think it would be as much of a problem as it is. But I see it as going a lot further than that, because it has an enforcement piece. And as I read the bill, it's basically saying, we don't like what the law is, so we're not going to follow it. And we're not going to let anybody who works for us follow the law. And that is a shot across the bow, and as was mentioned on the floor, I think it's makes this basically a Fort Sumter bill. This is a settled issue, whether we have to follow federal law or not. Now, you referred to what the legislature did when Governor Pawlenty violated the Constitution by taking the budgeting process away from the legislature. But what did the legislature do? We didn't just say, we set the budget, and this is the budget, and we're going to follow this budget. What did we do? We went to court. That's what you do. That's what the courts are for, to be arbiters. And that's not what this bill does. This bill simply says, we don't like the law, we're not following it. And Mr. Nelson and Representative Gottwald, you can't do that. We fought a civil war over that. And just to sort of make that point, on line 2.1 to 2.3, if you took out the words that are the essence of the thing that you don't like, that you're trying to stop here, in other words, if you said the power to, and then you put something else in there. For example, and not that anybody would do this, as Representative Simon said on the floor, but if you put in there the words, if you said the power to enforce segregation of the races is not found in the Constitution of the United States, et cetera, people would say, you can't do that. That's been decided. So whatever the thing is you don't like that you're trying to say we don't have to follow, and I'm not in any way saying that anybody is going that direction. I just want to make that clear. I'm just talking about the process here of the bill, what it does legally speaking. If you pick out something the state wants to do or doesn't want to do, and you just say, we declare that we can go our own way, and we're going to do that until somebody stops us, you're rehashing something that is long since settled, that has to do with the relationship between the states and the federal government. This is not a process we can do. A war has been fought over it. Minnesota fought on the other side from the way you're going here. And frankly, you know, if you want to say you don't like the Affordable Care Act, that's fine. Everybody knows it. But you just can't do this, period. And if you want to respond to that, I guess I'd be interested in your response.
I think you should respond, but I would prefer you do it at your closing remarks. If there are questions at this time, however, of this testifier, I'd like to get to those. Representative Hillstrom, then Wardlow. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess it wasn't really of this testifier. It was, again, another process question, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead with the question.
Mr. Chair, your statement was that you intend to send this bill to the floor. I was noticing that this bill was moved out of the committee that oversees the Attorney General's office and their budgeting issues. It was not passed out, but by motion was recalled from that committee. And my question, Mr. Chair, is why is it that no one believes that this bill that orders a state agency, or excuse me, the Attorney General's office, a constitutional office, to do something, doesn't have to go to the very committee that actually has jurisdiction over the budget of that committee?
Which committee?
Mr. Chair, it was in State Government Finance Committee, and by motion was recalled from that committee and re-referred to your committee, Mr. Chair. It has not been heard in that committee, and so my question is, it was sent to that committee, so clearly everyone believes that that committee has proper jurisdiction over this. It was my thought that this would then be going back to that committee. So my question, Mr. Chair, is why would you be sending this bill to the floor without having the very committee with jurisdiction over the Attorney General's office and budget, not even hearing this bill?
Well, the answer, Representative Hillstrom, is that I believe the Committee on State Government Finance determined there was no cost to state government in this bill, number one. Number two, that was the reason, I think, they declined to hear the bill and did not hear the bill. And the last thing is, one chair in this House, regardless of who the chair is, cannot force another chair to hear a bill. All we do is have purview to take a bill that's sent to us and or follow every bill that's introduced, determine whether it should come here, and then notify the author as such. So State Government Finance Chairman decided not to hear the bill, did not want to see the bill, did not have to see the bill, but we do.
Well, Mr. Chair, I just want to say that I really think that this has been the most incredible process of skipping committees and committees that don't have jurisdiction taking bills that I have seen in my 11 years in the Minnesota House of Representatives. And whether or not you have the votes to pass bills doesn't mean you don't have to respect the process. You are all elected to protect this process. And I just think that anytime you're ordering an entity to do something, at least the committee with jurisdiction has an obligation to hear. We already saw that the property tax bill didn't go to the property tax committee. Now we're seeing that the bill that involves the AG doesn't go to the committee that oversees it. I just think, Mr. Chair, we do have an obligation to protect this process, and I'm sorry to see that once again it's not being protected.
Well, Representative Hillstrom, my first thought was just to note your comments for the record and move along, because we do have a long agenda, but I've decided I want to ask you a question. Do you think this bill should not be in this committee?
Mr. Chair, I think that this bill should be in this committee, but I don't think that the motion should be to move this bill to the floor. I think the motion should be that this bill should go to the State Government Finance Committee. Go to the State Government Finance Committee, Mr. Chair.
Once again, I will remind you, the State Government Finance had it in their committee, and they decided not to hear it. I cannot force State Government Finance to hear it. I can welcome this bill or any bill to this committee. It's here. You just agreed with me. We should hear it. We are hearing it. And I can't send this bill anywhere. This committee can, and it will have a motion before it that it be passed and be recommended to the General Register. Do you have any further testifiers?
Yes.
Let's hear them. Two minutes. Please state your name. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, thank you. My name is Twyla Braze. I'm president of Citizens Council for Health Freedom, and it will be less than 10 minutes, I'm happy to say.
True.
Oh, good. Okay. Two. All right. That fits more like it. Okay. So I would like to say that there's been a lot of controversy over the federal law, and there are two ways that a legislature who might be concerned about the federal law can respond. One of those is on the defensive, and so we can try and prevent certain things from ever happening, such as the exchange or the Accountable Care Act, accountable care organizations. But the other way is to go on the offensive and to actually make a move to prevent something from happening here in a very different way. So I think that what this bill asserts is that this state acknowledges its sovereignty that is afforded to it in the Constitution to protect, and as legislators, to protect your own constituents, because after all, your constituents are members of this state or residents of this state as opposed to Congress, which has a whole different role. So this bill would allow or require, actually, the Attorney General to take protections for the people of this state against the federal law. And I can't remember who mentioned about the Constitution and the different judges' rulings, but I thought that Judge Vinson's ruling is very interesting because he talked about the fact that if you could force somebody to engage in commerce, and that was under the Commerce Clause, that the Commerce Clause is really only about commerce and commerce taking place. But if no commerce has taken place, in other words, somebody is not buying something, the Commerce Clause doesn't have an impact. And so if people aren't buying health insurance, there's no commerce happening. And Judge Vinson said something on the order of, otherwise you could start to force them to buy anything that the federal government decided that they wanted everyone to do, and use the Commerce Clause to say this is why you can force them to engage in commerce, when the Commerce Clause is only about those people who are already engaged in commerce. So the thing that I would say is to remember about the Act and why this is important is because what will happen under the Act is that your constituents will be forced to change insurance, they will be forced to buy more expensive insurance, and they will be forced into Medicaid, all of this without their consent. And I believe that this bill will actually protect people from those kind of changes which could hurt them.
Any questions of the witness? Any additional testimony? Representative Wardlow, you have a question?
Yes, Mr. Chair, but I think it's probably best to hold it until discussion of the bill.
All right. No, the public testimony is closed. I saw no further testimony. Hands being raised. We'll discuss the bill for 5 minutes, and then we're going to vote. Discussion. Representative Wardlow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Gottwell, for bringing this very important bill forward. As you said, this bill is about the 9th and 10th Amendments, but it's also, as Ms. Brace pointed out, about the enumerated powers of the Constitution. And, of course, if the federal government exceeds its enumerated powers under the Constitution, then the law that it passes is not constitutional, regardless of what the 9th and 10th Amendments say. The 9th and 10th Amendments, and especially the 10th Amendment, were added as sort of comfort language, if you will, to persuade certain states to pass, to ratify the Constitution. And the 10th Amendment has substantive effect beyond just restating the concepts inherent in the Constitution and the enumerated power structure of the Constitution insofar as the states cannot be commandeered for federal purposes. But I think the inquiry here should really focus on the enumerated powers piece of the Constitution. So that's really what's at the heart of this, and the Commerce Clause. That being said, we've heard discussion from the other side, points and questions that the federal government, the Supremacy Clause should apply, and that the ACA, being a federal law, should necessarily override any state laws to the contrary. But traditionally, the federal government has been the sole arbiter of what is constitutional since Marbury versus Madison. But what is the check on federal overreach of its enumerated powers? And if the federal government does exceed its enumerated powers, how can states assert their rights, and how can states and how do state legislatures assert their disagreement with what the federal government might have decided in kind of a chicken guard in the hen house scenario?
Representative Gottwald, I want you to limit your remarks. We are on discussion now, so I don't want any question and answer.
I understand.
Unless it's absolutely vital. I apologize for poking my nose in this, but I seem to have it here with the gavel. So be very brief.
Yeah, I will be. I thank you for the question, Representative Wardlow. Mr. Chair, obviously the Constitution envisions under the innumerable powers in the Ninth and Tenth Amendments a opportunity for states to invoke their own rights on behalf of their constituents. When they see something like the ACA that they consider unconstitutional. There was no attempt within the Constitution to say that states must simply accept without question anything the federal government tells them to do. And I think that's kind of the answer to the question. And so this bill is, in a sense, an answer to what Representative Wardlow is saying.
Further discussion, Representative Wardlow.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to respond to a couple points made by other members.
Go right
very
ahead.
Quickly.
Go ahead.
First of all, I don't think it's appropriate to bring difficult and contentious subjects that our nation has shed blood and hundreds of thousands of lives to fix into this discussion. You know, the Civil War was fought to eradicate an evil from the United States and from the world, that is slavery. And we won that war. The Union won that war, obviously. And so that's done. That's not what this bill is about. The Civil War was not fought about what this bill is talking about. It wasn't fought about health care. It wasn't fought about who should be the arbiter of what is constitutional. That's not what people were fighting and dying for. The Union fought to eradicate slavery, and then we did so. And we did so by amending the Constitution. And the Civil Rights Act, in fact, was passed under the 14th Amendment of the Constitution, the last piece of the 14th Amendment of the Constitution, which allows for legislation to enact the purposes of the 14th Amendment. So that's how we got the Civil Rights Act, in a very constitutional way, after we fought a war to achieve those constitutional amendments. So it's completely inappropriate, in my view, to bring that into this. And it's a red herring, and it's, I think, bordering on disrespectful to very legitimate viewpoints of people here arguing that our federal government is overreaching its constitutional boundaries in an entirely different subject area without regard to anything about slavery or anything related to that. So I'd just like to make that clear. That's offensive. And furthermore, if the law is unconstitutional, a priori, if the law is unconstitutional, it is unconstitutional, and therefore the Supremacy Clause would not apply to it, because if it's unconstitutional, it's not a law at all. It's void, and you don't even get the Supremacy Clause. The only question is who decides whether the law is unconstitutional. And if we all think the Supreme Court of the United States should be the sole arbiter of what is constitutional and what is not constitutional, well, then we should probably reread our oaths of office. Because I don't believe that we took an oath to uphold the decisions of the Supreme Court of the United States of America, but rather to uphold the Constitution of the United States and of Minnesota.
We have Representative Szymanski, Hillstrom, Liebling, and then Less. Representative Szymanski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If I may defer my comments to just a little later in this discussion.
There isn't going to be much later in this discussion.
Okay. Then I will proceed, Mr. Chairman. On the issue, this is not settled law, in my opinion, and various U.S. courts have ruled in both sides of this issue. But along with the judiciary and the executive branch, legislators have also taken an oath of office to uphold the Constitution of the United States. And as state legislators, we also, you know, have taken the oath to uphold the Minnesota's Constitution. And as legislators, we have a duty to act in defense of the citizens of Minnesota. And as the move of the present federal government, to me, is usurping the citizens' rights. And I think it's our duty as legislators to, you know, defend them on and work on their behalf. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. I have three other representatives, four other representatives that want to be heard from. Then we are going to get this matter before us. Representative Hillstrom, before you start, I think you said you were here now 11 years?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Well, I've been here 20, and I've worked with you for your 11. And you know, just chew on this for a while. I do uphold the process of the legislature, and I want to adhere to it. And I don't know, and frankly don't care many days, what other committees do, but I know this bill had to be here. And unfortunately, I can't rearrange the number who are voting on it, so, you know, let's go forward. I just want you to know that I do respect you, the members here, and this committee, and that's why we're hearing the bill. Representative Hillstrom, go
ahead. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I actually was going to get to the bill this time. So, just so you know. You have done a great job, Mr. Chair, and it has been a pleasure to work with you in these areas. I want to draw your attention to line 2.14 to 2.17, and there's been a lot of discussion about upholding the United States Constitution in this committee. I think it's also important that we uphold the Minnesota Constitution, and I want members to really take a look at this, because it's saying that no public official, employee, or agent of the state of Minnesota or any political subdivision shall act to impose, collect, enforce, or effectuate any penalty in the state of Minnesota that violates the public policy set forth in this section. Mr. Chair, you have been very, very careful in your omnibus bills over these years as we request, the Supreme Court of the state of Minnesota to do or not to do something, right? We request that they do it. We request that the University of Minnesota, who is a land-grant institution, to do certain things. We don't order them to do them. We fund them, but we do not, under our Constitution, order those folks to do so. So I would actually argue that this section is directly contrary to Minnesota's practice, as well as likely Minnesota's Constitution, in what we order or do not order these different branches of government to do, Mr. Chair. So you have been very careful in your omnibus bills over the years, and I even noticed this year you requested the Supreme Court to look at their insurance. You didn't order them to do so. I think you understand what our role is in this process, Mr. Chair, and I'm sorry to see that this bill doesn't.
Representative Hillstrom, thank you for your remarks, and I don't believe I'm an author on this bill. I just happen to be sitting in this chair while we're hearing it. Representative Liebling, Les Champion. Liebling.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I just need to respond to a couple of things that were said. And, you know, the real thing here is, the real question is, how does a state invoke its rights? Representative Wardlow, how do we do that? And I think that it's very clear how we do that. We do it through the courts. If we believe that our rights as a state are violated, we tell the courts that that is what we believe, and we have that process. We do not declare that we just are not going to follow the law. And as you know, the law is presumed constitutional. Now, it was mentioned, you know, you say that it's disrespectful to say that this is like what's been done before in the past, where to invoke the Civil War and to talk about the battles that were fought over segregation. I don't think it's disrespectful. I think it's the truth. You know, Governor Wallace stood in the schoolhouse door and said, "This is states' rights. We don't have to follow the law." And he was wrong. That is not how you invoke states' rights. Finally, Representative Shemansky was talking about, I think it was Representative Shemansky, somebody was talking about that we also have the obligation to follow the Constitution, and we do. I absolutely agree with that. I think that what that means is that if legislators believe a bill is not constitutional, we are obligated not to vote for it. And I believe that this bill is not constitutional, and therefore we as legislators are violating our oaths if we vote for it. And I think that's a very important principle, and obviously we disagree about whether this is constitutional, but I believe that that is where we find our obligation to follow the law. We don't tell the state and our employees and the people who we have jurisdiction over to disregard federal law because we don't agree with it. That is not how we play out our obligation. And, Mr. Chair, I would ask for a roll call on this bill.
So noted. We'll have one, Representative. Let's try to hold it to 1 minute, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, I have general disagreement with statements of public policy and bills. I don't know if that was discussed while I was here, but I don't even know what that means. Could put in, you know, I support mom home and apple pie, and encourage all public officials of the state to enact legislation or take actions commensurate with that intent or purpose. It doesn't mean anything, and it's a filler for when you don't have actual application for real laws. But with respect, I did, Mr. Chair, wanted to address Representative Wardlow's comments, because I was surprised at the comments. I think absolutely, members, I spent 7 months out of the last 17 south of the Mason-Dixon line. And you can bet that many of the people I talk to down there don't call it the Civil War. They call it the War of Northern Aggression. And it was not fought over slavery down there. It was not fought over slavery. It was fought over states' rights. And you can be sure that every single person who supported the war down there supported states' rights over the oppressive regime of the federal government. And that's how they justified it. So I don't think it's as clear-cut in these laws as it always seems to be. And when you have what's in subdivision 3 here, what reads like a manifesto about the 10th Amendment or what have you, using magical terms like constitutionally recognized inalienable rights of liberty and sovereign power, that discussion was not started by Representative Liebling. It was started by the commentary of the bill. So inevitably, it raises the commentary and the discussion about this bill to a level that harkens back to some of the most significant struggles over the Constitution in this nation's history, which includes the Civil War, which is why I think the questions asked by Representative Liebling were relevant. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Champion, 1 minute, then I'm going to make a statement, then we're going to vote.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, let me say, members, I've been listening to the commentary and the comments about this particular bill, and one thing that is true, Representative Wardlaw, is that we as attorneys and as individuals or critical thinkers, we all have opinions. And I can have an opinion as it pertains to the constitutionality of a law, but I am not the person who sits in the seat of the Supreme Court to say if something is constitutional or not. The challenge is when we, being well-intentioned and the intelligent individuals that we are, overreach. The whole reason for having checks and balances is so that no one is overreaching. And when a legislature decides that something is unconstitutional, which is a role for the court, then that becomes problematic, and that goes against the intent of our framers. Let me also say this. You spoke so eloquently about whether we should be looking at the notion of slavery and whether that is something that should be invoked here. But perhaps I might lead you to another a piece of history. I'm sure that you recognize 1828 to 1832, when South Carolina said that they did not want to have to pay the tax or the tariff. And they decided that they were going to wedge or fight against that declaration. And I want you to understand that Representative Liebling and the others are exactly right when they say, look, when you look at something from any perspective, South will say, hey, it's states' rights. What about us exerting our states' rights? In the North, we have a different perspective. But I watched a movie that says vantage point is very important, because from where you sit and from your perspective will determine what your opinion is. And so I think that we are overreaching, that we are in certain states' rights, that we fail to look at the history and think of the importance of all these guiding principles, that we have checks and balances. And we may have strong opinions, but it's important for us to respect our own Constitution and the democracy that we say that we are here to uphold.
Representative Champion, thank you. Representative Gottwald, I'm going to ask you a question, and then I'm going to give you the answer, and then I'm going to see if you agree with it. And then we're going to a roll call vote. So listen carefully. I get to vote here, too. If your bill passes, becomes law in the state of Minnesota, then if the Supreme Court of the United States of America upholds the ACA, the impact on your bill is that it's then unconstitutional. And the answer is yes. Roll's been requested.
Smith?
Yes.
Johnson?
No.
Szymanski?
Yes.
Anderson?
Yes.
Champion?
No.
Cornish?
Yes.
Grunhagen?
Yes.
Hillstrom?
No.
Creaso?
Yes.
Lesh?
No.
Liebling?
No.
Mazerell?
Yes.
Moline?
No.
Schumacher?
Yes.
Vogel?
Yes.
Wardlow?
Yes.
There being 10 votes in favor and 6 votes against, the motion prevails. The bill is recommended to pass, be placed in the general register. Thank you, everyone. There are 4 bills left on the agenda, of all 4 of which are the chairman's, and we're going to get at least through 2 of them. They're both going to be laid over. I don't want to have to come back at 8 o'clock to hear 2 bills just to lay them over, so let's keep our remarks brief. 1298, Judge Dinn.
Mr. Chairman,
Representative Smith,
move this file 1298 that it be recommended to pass, then after testimony and questions, ask you to lay it over. I have with me Judge Dinn. I'll let him present the bill, what it does. We're asking for a change in the way orders be prepared by the court and handled. So I'd ask Judge Dinn to run through this really quickly.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, it's a pleasure to be here. And real quick comment, thank you for the last discussion. My law clerk and her high school daughter are here. What a great civics lesson for her.
Excuse me, Mayor, Representative Smith, do you have an author's amendment to add to this bill?
I guess if you're asking, there might be one in the packet. House file H1298A1, I'd ask that the committee give me the courtesy of attaching that on the bill. I move the amendment.
All right. Representative Smith offers the A1 amendment. Any discussion? Hearing none, we'll move to a vote. All in favor of the A1 amendment to House File 1298, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Again, after amendment presentation, adopt. I'd ask the bill be laid over. Judge Dinn, if you could go ahead. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Judge Jim Dinn. I've been a sitting court judge in Isani County for 24 years, and I've also been a member of the Board of Judicial Standards for 8 years, from 2000 to 2008, serving as chair of the board at my last year there. I am here representing the Minnesota District Judges Association today, asking you to consider an amendment to the Minnesota Statute 546.27, which we call the 90-day statute, to create a statutory early intervention by chief judges to assist judges who happen to have time delay problems, medical problems, other types of problems. We Minnesota judges handle about 7,000 cases a year. We also handle about 5,000 other matters a year. We've been calculating that. And we are very active and continue to be more active in other responsibilities as people use attorneys less. Pro sayers come in front of the court before us. So we're under much stress as we deal with people who, frankly, don't understand the law on there. Because of lack of staff, hiring freezes, judges have been struggling with meeting time periods for some time. And as a member of the Board of Judicial Standards, we dealt by statute, we were required by statute to deal with judges who had surpassed that time period. And what we're asking simply is that we allow chief judges to be involved, and I should mention all chief judges from the state of Minnesota have been queried and welcome the opportunity to get involved early on with judges who pass the time limit. Rather than initially going to the board and seeking sanctions that that do happen, which could include public reprimands, we're asking that chief judges be involved at the early end to work with judges to develop time plans, to deal with medical issues, other types of issues, working with the board. my experience is that with the board, and I should mention, on the board, and that's still true today, it's a very busy board, and they're dealing with high-profile matters that deal with demeanor and judicial conflicts. This matter has to do with time, the timeliness of making decisions for all our constituents out there, and it's very important, but it's also something that we feel that chief judges are, at the first onset and during the second violation, better equipped to handle and work with judges. That, in essence, is what the amendment is. We think it is a proactive measure to help citizens who come before us that expect and are entitled to timely decisions.
Great. Thank you, Judge Steen. Representative Hillstrom, you have a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's more of a statement. Representative Smith, I'm likely going to be supporting your bill here, but I just want to say I believe the reason this bill is here is because we underfund the courts and we have too few judges. We're 20 judges short, and so judges do not have adequate time to do the job that they are required to do in the amount of time that we have in the statutes. And so right now I believe that we have a situation where judges are rendering their decisions in whatever time limit they now are given because the courts are overcrowded, they have too high a caseloads. And so what's happening is that some judges are being turned into the Board of Judicial Standards for not meeting this timeline that we have in statutes because we are underfunding them, we're 20 judges short, and we are not doing the job that we're supposed to be doing as the legislature. So, Mr. Chair, I will likely be supporting your bill because of that, but I really think we should be taking care of the courts rather than just coming up with these fixes.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hillstrom, I welcome your comments sincerely. First of all, this bill was brought to me by the Minnesota District Judges Association, so they're behind this. Secondly, we had a target to live within when we put our fiscal bill together, and you saw how we unfortunately moved numbers into the courts. Third, if I was writing the check, we would reverse the choking that we've been handing the judiciary over the last 4, 5, 6 years. Thank you for your comments. We do have opposition testimony. I've asked them to be brief. Need to get this in with the next couple of minutes.
All right. Anyone else to testify on this bill? Please step forward.
By the way, Judge Dean, I apologize for mispronouncing your name. Every time I get to this side of the table, I get a little nervous, and I apologize for mispronouncing your name. Go ahead.
Thank you, Representative Smith. Please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning. Pat Sexton. I am a member of the Board on Judicial Standards, have been for the last 6+ years and was chair for 2 years. And I first have to say that as a board member who sees a lot of maybe not the best judges, Judge Dean is the exact type of judge that we want on the bench, and have a great deal of respect for him. Have had a difference of opinion with him while we were both on the board. Difference still remains. Bottom line is the question you have to ask is, will this change result? There are two changes. First off, they're removing the statement that the judge can't get paid for a late file. If you'll notice, that line is now stricken. Second, you have to ask yourself, will this result in fewer cases being delayed or not? We currently have a very efficient, effective system. We see if a file is late. We ask the judge why that was late. We come to some resolution. They are, in our minds, putting together a more convoluted, less uniform system by which every chief judge will now act most likely differently than another chief judge. We believe the current system works. It is in the best interest of the populace. Justice delayed is justice denied, and we just have a difference of opinion. I promised you I'd be brief.
I appreciate it.
Thank you. Representative Smith.
Did you want to testify? Okay. We're going to have one last testimony, and if we bring this bill back up in the week after break, we'll probably open this up for additional testimony. But Mr. Paul, would you open up and tell us why I'm not doing the right thing here today?
Welcome to our committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm David Paul. I'm the Executive Secretary to the Board on Judicial Standards, and I understand your time constraints. I'm going to be very brief. One thing this bill does is it sets up some conflict problems, and those conflicts are both perceived and actual. The perceived conflicts is, as I heard someone say previously, there's the fox watching the chicken house in this case. It doesn't mean it's actually the case, but this is the first time that a judge at the same level as another judge would have a responsibility to discipline that judge. To the public, which this bill was originally passed for, it it seems, and I get asked this all the time as executive secretary, why should I complain to you? You're just the fox watching the chicken house. But it is a problem in the minds of the public, and I think that this is a perceived problem that the committee should be aware of. The second is an actual conflict, and this is that chief judges are elected by their peers, and very often they can run for additional terms. You might have a chief judge who's actually trying to discipline or look into a case that might be a friend of his or hers. So it's just not a good problem. The legislature years ago gave this to us because they knew that under the code in the first place, it was going to be the board's duty to enforce diligent and efficient decisions. And since the legislature wanted to put a limit on it, they said, why not let the board do it? They're doing it anyway. I don't think that there's any reason to change that. The board has been doing a good job at it, and the board would be against this.
Mr. Chairman, thank you for your time. If you'd lay the bill over.
All right. The chair recommends that House File 1298 be laid over for further consideration.
Mr. Chairman, there are three other bills on the agenda. We're not going to come back tonight just for my bills. That's not going to happen. So we'll just move the agenda to the next hearing, and I'd ask you to adjourn the meeting for this.
All right. Thank you, Representative Smith. There being no further business today, the Judiciary Policy and Finance Committee will stand adjourned until 8:15 a.m. Tuesday, April 26th, or subject to the call of the chair. We are adjourned.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.